If you think you can't go from politics to the divide, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, and welcome. I'm Carol Gold, and yes, this is Above the Fray. The number here is 914-803-4522 if you'd like to get in on the discussion. My co-host will be joining me soon. That's Steve Clark. And until he does, let me just set the framework for tonight's show. Over the last week or week and a half, there has been kind of a battle of the words and battle of concepts going on between a blogger on The Blaze, which is an internet website, obviously, and also a network in and of itself, both online television and radio, which Glenn Beck owns. Matt Walsh is a blogger who writes for The Blaze, and a woman named Stephanie Martin who writes for the website Gawker. And this sort of fray, hopefully we like to be above the fray here, but this fray that they've been involved in for the past, I don't know, week and a half, I guess, or more, maybe 2 weeks, began with Matt Walsh writing a blog post about Bruce Jenner, Bruce / Caitlyn Jenner. I never know what to call him, her. And that's just my honest reaction. I really don't know what to call him or her. I know what she would like to be called, and I know who I think he is, so I'm conflicted. But anyway, and maybe that's not such an aside, maybe that's actually the gist and the sort of the guts of what this back and forth between Matt Walsh and Stephanie Martin of Gawker has been. So Matt Walsh wrote a piece that was, Matt Walsh is a, you know, is an unabashed Christian. He's a conservative, he's a millennial, and so he put forth his opinions under all of those categories, all of those being who he is, and he spoke a lot about Bruce Jenner's transition, and also about the hypocrisy in the feminist movement for all of those feminists and women in media who came out in support of the cover of Vanity Fair and Bruce Jenner's transition into Caitlyn Jenner. Because the point he was making, among other points, and I know when Steve comes on the air with us, he will share some of those other points that Matt Walsh made originally, that it's hypocritical to oogle at Bruce Jenner looking like a sexy woman dressed in a corset on the cover of Vanity Fair with long hair and makeup and breasts that have been both enhanced, both physically through silicone and through photoshopping, and to somehow laud him or praise him for his courage, and I use that in quotes, in coming out on the cover in that way, when in fact everything the feminist movement fought for in the late decades of the 20th century was for women not to be judged that way, not to have to be pinup models in order to receive attention or credibility or self-worth. So having set that framework up, that's what Matt Walsh wrote about, Stephanie Martin came back at him with a vengeance, basically calling him a hypocrite in terms of his biblical references, and actually saying that Jesus would have hated what Matt Walsh stood for, when there's irony in that sentence alone that we'll get to shortly. But let me bring Steve on air. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Carol.
Steve, I know you came into the show late, but hopefully you heard enough of the setup. I'd like you to to pick it up from, you probably have a better memory, or at least a better understanding, being Christian yourself, of the perspective that Matt Walsh came from in that first piece. And then we can move on to talk about the back and forth that took place after that.
Sure. So Matt Walsh is not only Christian, but he's a conservative Catholic writer. Catholic writers have a formed doctrine based on natural law that marriage is created by God for the betterment of man. One is, you know, you can say man is created in the image of God, woman is created in the image of God. The union of man and woman together in the Catholic faith is a sacrament that sex is a good thing between a man and a woman. It's, it enables things for the procreation of children, that children are a blessing. All these things are not only based on natural law, but they're actually supernatural in that sense that there's a deeper principle than, especially for example in marriage, of that it's a supernatural entity, the supernatural benefit that God has created with the help of man. So I think that's the backdrop that Matt Walsh was getting at, and I would say that the unfortunate thing is that there's a couple things in the society that we live in today. There's not only a complete lack of understanding of that point of view now. It's almost frowned upon and laughed at. And the best way I can probably give it to you is that, having been in the military as well, is that it's very easy for ex-military people to spot articles written in the military, because for the most part, most writers get it absolutely wrong what the military is about. They never quite get it right. And it's the same when I look at the arguments against Matt Walsh. It's not that Matt Walsh is wrong or right. Just leave that alone for a second. They just have the writers that critique Matt Walsh have no idea where he's getting that opinion from, where he's basing that idea from. They have no framework or concept really to even critique it. They're just so far removed from understanding where Matt Walsh is coming from that it makes the article even, you know, it makes her response to his article even funny. Like there's no sense of her trying to understand his point of view. It would be like complete and total Martian, and Matt Walsh has kind of invented these things and said these things, and like it's completely out of left field. And the reality is, you know, just to understand Catholic doctrine is formed over centuries. It's formed over many, many years. Catholic doctrine at times changes based on what we would call divine intervention, or man's beginning to understand God's will, you know, more profoundly as he matures. But again, that article does not even address or can't even comprehend that point of view that Matt Walsh. And I think that's even part, you know, a very interesting story in itself, is that we now have a society that, like in this article that, you know, the Gawk article that criticizes Matt Walsh, she no longer can even understand his point of view. So I think that's part of, I think, the important discussion. Don't you think, Carol?
I do. And as an attorney, I will tell you that one of the things you learn very early in law school, and you probably would learn it on a debate team even in high school, is that in order to truly prepare for a case, prepare for if you're going to litigate a case in a courtroom, and even if you're not, if you're just trying to negotiate it, you have to not only look at your case, you have to put yourself on the other side and prepare the other attorney's case. Because the only way that you can truly set forth your position and be able to defend whatever might come at you is if you anticipate what might come at you. So there's a long history in both the debating world, but also in the world of law, where you don't just look at your viewpoint. You also put yourself to the best of your ability in the shoes of your adversary or your opponent. And I think that's what you're talking about that was lacking and that is often lacking in today's, I can't call them debates, in today's sort of banging of heads, one position against the other, particularly, and I'm going to say this, particularly I see it when we're talking about the left, the political left, coming at the political right. I find that the political left is particularly disinterested in understanding the merits of the other side. And it really came through in Stephanie Martin's piece, in her initial retort to Matt Walsh, or in her retort to Matt Walsh, because not only did she not really address, and certainly not respectfully address, some of the points he raised, to the extent that she did address them, she addressed them by taking biblical statements out of context, because she was, you know, it's like a lot of times people say, you know, science is the act of proving your hypothesis right, right? So a lot of people say what's wrong with science is, as we've seen with global warming and climate change and all the other names it has, there was a real effort to prove the premise, not to find out if the premise was true, but to prove the premise. And so when you go down that road, you're going down the road of manipulation of the truth, manipulation of the facts, if you're talking about science or law. And in the case of just, you know, normal everyday argument or adversarial conversation, you're talking about taking things out of context to prove your point, and that's what she did. She ignored some of what needed to be addressed. She addressed what she wanted to address, and she addressed it disingenuously, because if you went to the context within which the things were said, and I'm going to say, give you something in particular, Steve, that stuck out for me. She used, and I'm obviously an Old Testament Jew. I'm not a New Testament Christian, so if I get this wrong, you'll tell me. She used Jesus's comments about eunuchs. eunuchs, eunuchs, men who are either born without a penis, men who were at the time castrated by the Romans, or people who chose to be celibate by dedicating their life to God and closing off that sexual outlet of energy so that spiritually they could elevate themselves. He talks about those three categories, and he says people should be able to live, and he's talking about eunuchs specifically, that they should be able to live the way they are. He was never saying anything about being gay or electing to be gay or being born gay. He was never discussing any of that. He was discussing what I just said. And yet Stephanie Martin took that out of the context of what Jesus had said in relationship to eunuchs, and she used it to say that Jesus would have been on board for transgender, I could go on probably for 5 minutes with new transes that we have. You can now transition species, you can transition gender, you can transition race, this week we learned you can be white and decide you're black, and voila, you're the head of the NAACP in Spokane, Washington. So, you know, it's that. It's this complete fiction that facts don't matter, that context doesn't matter, and that because I say it, and I say it with humor, sarcasm, and an exclamation point, it makes me right, and it negates you. That's what bothers me, Steve.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I think there's an interesting point that the left always gets wrong. And there's a lady here in Texas, University of Dallas, named Janet Smith, a Catholic writer, and she writes extensively about the teachings of the Catholic Church, especially as it relates to sex. And I think one of the points that she, you know, she really goes into is that the one of the left paradigms or arguments you would say that they use against the right is that, you know, the right is against homosexual sex. That's kind of the big sticking point. And in the Catholic Church, the teachings of the Church, you know, a lot of it is very similar to most, you know, religions. It's not a gay thing. It's not one of these things that they belabor the point on. Really, one of the things that you know, kind of the main principle is that sex is a gift from God that should be used as for procreation, and the sin of adultery, fornication, all the sexual sins that you want to belabor are treated on par with homosexual sex. I mean, it's all treated as something that draws man away from God. So there's not a huge differentiation between homosexual sex and adultery. They're both seen as something that's, you know, for simplistic sake, I'm saying this incorrectly, but it's outside the norm. We'll say that for the argument's sake. But the left just gets wrapped around this, that the Catholics are targeting homosexuals and transgender, which is further from the truth. Again, it's a complete misunderstanding of what the teaching is. And it goes back to your point, is that, you know, I think we live in a society, like you were saying before, that we can no longer understand another person's point of view. And I think it gets back to the education. Instead of trying to understand the other person's point of view, you're just labeled as an idiot or a nincompoop or somebody of lesser intelligence because you don't hold this new truth to be the real truth, that, you know, that homosexual sex is equates to, you know, any other type of sex, that transgender is just as normal as anything else. And if you differ from that opinion, then you are the one that's going to be criticized and, you know, taken to the shed. So that's where I think is that article really got, you know, I think got really people riled up, and I think that's really what Matt Walsh responded to in that manner.
Well, I would say, first of all, that in all fairness, when I first read her article, I had read Matt Walsh's article first, and I wanted to read her article, her post, with an open mind and trying to give her the benefit of the doubt because of the following. You know, we have people in this world who look at religion, whether they're Muslim or Jewish or Christian or Catholic, they look at religion as doctrine, as dogma, as the word of God, fundamentalism. They look at the literal word of the text, and they believe that that is what is their guiding post. There are a tremendous amount of people in the world who look at religious writing as something to be interpreted, that it is allegorical or it's symbolic, and that it's not the literal word. And it doesn't do anyone any good to throw stones at the other approach to religion, because each one has an argument and each one could be right. We'll never know. Everybody chooses up their own side and how they want to get to God. So I wanted to read her post hoping that what I was going to read was an intelligent response and a meritorious response to what Walsh had written. And that, obviously, as I said earlier, that's not what I got. It's also not to say that it can't be done. You know who Penn Jillette is of Penn and Teller?
Yeah, sure.
Penn Jillette is an agnostic, and he is constantly in debates with very religious people, and all of his life, he lives within a moral, ethical context, but absolutely no religious context. He doesn't believe in religion. He doesn't believe in God. But when you listen to him debate a highly religious fundamentalist believing person, it is a fascinating conversation to listen to, because there's such an intellect on both sides, there's a mutual respect for difference, and there are meritorious arguments. And so the real harm that I think people like Jennifer Martin do to her side, number one, she dumbs down the argument. She dumbs down the entire conversation. Now, I'd also argue that Matt Walsh dumbed it down in his reply. He got snarky in his reply. He went down to her level in his reply. And although he was vehemently and adamantly defending Jesus as he perceives Jesus and his teachings as he perceives them, he undermined himself. And I think, Steve, you and I might have even had this conversation off air where we kind of both agreed he might have been best never to have answered her and just allowed both pieces to rise or fall on their merits, because his first piece had merit. And his response to her, you know, as I said, it brought him down as well. And as you told me, Steve, and I was not aware of this, Gawker is a site that, as I've learned from you, it really exists to draw traffic to itself. And it does that by taking out people periodically, just ripping people apart, as she did with her response to Matt Walsh. So I think there's an argument always, there's a debate always to be had about any topic, because there's always, as we say in law, three sides to every story, yours, mine, and the truth. So I think intelligent debate is healthy, and meeting, you know, on the field of ideas is always the way to grow and improve things for everyone. But that's what doesn't happen anymore in this country. What happens is what happened with Gawker's response to Matt Walsh and then Matt Walsh's response to her. And you're right, Steve. There's so much intolerance around trying to understand the other person's side, trying to be open to maybe learning something from the other person. We've shut down those avenues. And so what we have is a nation shouting at each other, whether it's Matt Walsh and Stephanie Martin from Gawker, or it's, you know, Black Lives Matter, or it's Democrats against Republicans. We have a nation shouting at one another, and there's very little opportunity for genuine exchange of ideas. And, I mean, that's really a dangerous place to be, because the thing that's been so great about the United States has always been free speech and the free exchange of ideas, even the ideas that you found offensive, because as I said earlier, you never know where you're going to learn something or gain a piece of wisdom. I mean, I'm sure somewhere in his lifetime, even what's the guy's name from Penthouse?
Oh, Bob Luciani?
Is that him, or who's the one in the wheelchair?
Oh, Larry Flynn from Hustler.
I'm sure even in his lifetime, as crass and crude as he can be, I'm sure even Larry Flynn has said something intelligent that could have been helpful to someone. But if you close off the possibility that someone could have something to say that could be of value, then you close off every idea but your own. And if you only have your own ideas, then there's never going to be very much growth, because the growth comes from the interaction, not from playing over and over again what you know. You know, before I turn it back to you, Steve, I always say I love to listen to people. Why? Because I know everything I have to say. When I sit down with someone, I want to let them talk, and I want to hear what they have to say, because otherwise, I can only be telling them what I already know, and I already know it. So it isn't that I don't want to dialogue with people, but I first want to give them a chance to be heard, because that's where my opportunity to learn comes from.
Yeah, Carol, the thing that I think is for people to understand is that you know, part of the news story that you see nowadays, it's there are real news stories, but there also is a massive amount of manipulation. The way that web traffic works, and I used to do a lot of this for sites that I used to run, is that it's newsjacking, basically, where you try to catapult your news story based off the work of somebody else. So Matt Walsh wrote an important piece. He wrote for The Blaze, and I forget the stats, but essentially it was the number one piece that was being circulated on the web that day, but close to it. And so what Gawker did is that, realizing that this news story was getting a lot of traction, what sites like Gawker do and similar sites like that, they're in the traffic business. They have a business of getting people to their site. So many times they'll just take a snarky, a very left-leaning hit pieces, because they know if they can get that, if they can siphon off some of the traffic from Matt Walsh's site, their site is going to benefit as well. So there's a whole business behind some of these hit pieces, how these sites respond and how they write these articles. So it's important for people, when they read these things, is a lot of what we're reading, a lot of what we're seeing on the media is not the truth. It's an element of the business side of getting people to the site. There was a great story about Breitbart that he ran a news story, and I'll make this quick because I know we're running out of time. But he ran a news story one day, and the news story, he purposely edited out the information. Because he purposely edited out the information, it ran the second day, and on the third day he responded. So one piece of news was able to run the news cycle for three different days. And one of the commentators asked him, well, why didn't everybody go out at Breitbart for clearly sending out bad information to the media? And the response to the media was, well, we love a guy like Breitbart because he gave us 3 days of business from one news story. We love guys like that. And Breitbart was a guy who worked for the Huffington Post, the Drudge Report, and for his, and later developed his own site, Breitbart, which are, I would consider, three of the most influential, or one of the top most influential sites that are out there, Drudge and definitely the Huffington Post. And he was a guy that knew how to manipulate the stories. My point is that people have captured some of the essence of what Breitbart does and what Drudge does and the Huffington Post does, is that they're, there's a business behind the media, and so some of the stories that you get are, for the main reasons, inflammatory. And at the same time, they're set up purposely many times to deceive people what the truth is. It's just the opposite of what we think the media is supposed to be. They're actually reporting the opposite because they're trying to generate news. So, again, it's just one of those things that as news consumers like you and I both are, we always have to be aware of, is, how is the story being manipulated, and why am I even being seeing this story? What's the point of me even seeing this story? There's a story behind the story at the same time.
We made the point in the first part of the show just now about the lack of truthfulness in the debate, sort of the lack of intelligent dialogue that's based in merit as opposed to based in emotion. There's another factor, Steve, that I want to bring in here, and it has to do with the blog post that I put up on our site today at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com. It has to do with what is compounding our inability to converse with one another is the unbelievable manufacturing of definitions that are happening now almost on a daily basis. If words keep changing what they mean, and new words keep entering the lexicon based on the most absurd foundations, how in the world are we going to have conversations where we even know, A, what we're talking about, or B, if we're talking about the same thing? The thing that just struck me today that caused me to write that piece was reading the word cisgender, C-I-S-G-E-N-D-E-R. I read it. Where did I read it? In the last couple days, I don't remember what article I read it in, but I came to know after looking it up on the web that cisgender means, if you're born a woman and you grow up to think you're a woman and you act like a woman and therefore you are a woman, that's cisgender. If you're born a man and you grow up to be a man and you think you're a man, that's cisgender. cisgender, in my mind, is what we used to call normal. It was like the way things were. Now, because we have a word transgender, somebody decided you needed to offset and equalize transgender with another word. So rather than marginalizing transgender, which it is, it's a marginalization of our culture. It's not the mainstream. Being gay is not the mainstream. In fact, an Atlantic Monthly article cited a study that was done which said that 2 to 3% of the population is gay. Yet when you poll the population, people think 25% of the population is gay. The reason for that discrepancy, and by the way, if we give it the benefit of the doubt and we take the most extreme gay organization statistics, at the very outset, they say it's 8%. So somewhere between 2 and 8%, 8 being the most extreme, of the population is gay. But most people in the country think that 25% of the country is gay. Why? Because the media promotes that. Because it's always in the lead, it's always the lead story. Just like the black person getting hit by the white cop is always the lead story, and when it happens the other way around, there's no lead. It's buried somewhere on the 10th page. Because the culture is manipulated by the language, by the presentation of the facts, by the prioritization of what matters. We're told what matters. So, but the conflict, the psychological conflict is almost overwhelming. If you have 20 years of feminism trying to say that women should not be turned into sex objects, And they work really hard to make that happen. And then you have Bruce Jenner appear as Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of Vanity Fair, dressed in a corset, looking as sexy as humanly possible for whatever it is he is in the moment or she is in the moment, but clearly trying to portray a woman who is hot, right? Then where's the sanity in all of this? Those same people who were screaming feminism were applauding Bruce Jenner for becoming the very symbol of what they fought for 20 years to undo. So this combination of both language becoming whatever you want it to be, definitions becoming whatever you want them to be. Marriage is no longer between a man and a woman, right? I mean, the Supreme Court is going to decide this case before its term is over on June 29th, and most people think they're going to come down making marriage not between a man and a woman as law of the land. So regardless of what the states do, they will now be overruled by federal law, which will allow a man and a man or a woman and a man to be considered a marriage. So as definitions change, and I'm not saying things should never change. I mean, you know, hopefully I wouldn't have been one of those people who said, oh, my God, I can't give up my horse or my buggy because this thing that makes noise and has a combustion engine is never going to get anywhere. I mean, words have to change. I wrote a book 2 years ago called The Lightworker's Handbook, A Spiritual Guide to Eliminating Fear. And the back of that book is 84 words redefined for the 21st century. I redefined them within the context of spirituality. I'm not saying words should never have different definitions. I'm just saying when nothing means anything anymore, when a white person can decide they're black and fake their blackness through their entire life and wind up the president of the NAACP in Spokane, Washington, and for a few days have an awful lot of people blogging that she was courageous, that took, you know, all kinds of courage to do that, and she should be able to think she's black because you should be able to think whatever you are, whatever you want to be. Well, if I woke up this morning and I decided I was Irish, but I happen to be Jewish, and therefore, you know, I want some kind of special treatment on St. Paddy's Day, or if I wake up tomorrow morning and decide I'm Asian, you know, does that make me good in math tomorrow? I mean, what does it all mean? It passes the point of sanity where we have no boundaries anymore. I think that's our biggest problem. Boundaries need to constantly be expanded, and limits should always be pushed. but we're not expanding or pushing. We're completely eliminating. In fact, I'll leave this thought with you, Steve. We're doing what Michelle Obama said we would have to do, said what Barack was going to do in 2008 when he ran for president, and she said, Barack knows we're going to have to change our history. We're going to have to change our traditions. Barack knows we're going to have to move in a new direction. That's exactly what the last, 6 years have gotten us, going on 7. It has gotten us a culture that is adrift, without boundaries, in the midst of profound change, absent leadership at every level, in our churches, in our synagogues, in our presidency, in our state houses. We are starving for leadership. And the last time a nation was starved for leadership, Adolf Hitler showed up and said, I've got the bread, and I've got your integrity and your honor back, and just follow me. It's a dangerous time, Steve.
Yeah, I think, you know, the part of it is that the media is unwilling or unable to engage on the other side to, you know, to give the other side of the story. So you know, if you just look at popular culture, if you look at, especially you see this on TV, that there's always the, you know, typical gay couple. There's always a typical, there's always a tension story between, if you look at the typical story on television, is that society oppresses gays and gays are the minorities. And it's a common theme that gets presented over and over and over again, to the point, I think people get beat up on it, in the same way that I think it's an ongoing story with racism, that people are bigoted, and look at all the white people that, you know, are prejudiced against the black people. I'm not saying that these issues don't exist, because they probably do. But the fact of the matter is that the way that the media tends to portray these stories, it makes it seem like that's the only story out there. That's the only agenda out there, that there are, in the media world, there's gays everywhere being oppressed, that there's millions and millions of gays out there, like you said, up to 10% of the population.
Eight at the most extreme, up to 8% at the most extreme.
I think some of the reports that, you know, looking back at your article, you said most of the people think it's around 20%.
25%.
Historically, everything that I've ever read is about 1% to 2% of the population. So my point is that, you know, Stalin got this right when he said it from the get-go, is that the ability for the media to influence what people believe is tremendous. And especially if you have a generation that just really consumes media the way that they do. And I would say it's really, we're a society that consumes media in vignettes with small slices of information. I would say if you look at it from Twitter to Vine, all these different forms of media that are short and to the point. And think about it, there's, in those short and to the point powerful messages, there's no real time to really reflect, to think about things. And that only comes from, you know, silence, meditation, contemplation, religion, reading a lot, having a diverse background to absorb lots of information, and then to come up with your own opinion. But I would say the way that the younger generations are being trained, it's much easier to influence them. Now, I work with a lot of young people. I work with a lot of young kids, and that I would say younger than me. And it amazes me to no end what they think passes as knowledge. And I'm not one to say I'm the smartest guy in the world, but I've read lots and lots of books, and I've been to lots and lots of places, so I think I have a pretty good background or of understanding of the basics of how life works. But I becoming, you know, I would say a great majority of the population does not have that sense of self-reflection, but I think it was very common from generations past, just by the way that they're being exposed and how they're growing up. I would say really no fault of their own. It's just the way that the media now engages with the audience now, they can send out much more powerful messages in ways that they couldn't do in the past. And it's I think it's much more powerful and much more influential. So I think it's a much harder battle now to win in the engagement and battle of ideas now.
Well, those snippets, those vignettes that you talked about, those one-liners or three-liners, they've evolved also because of the speed at which we live, thank you, technology. I mean, it goes hand in hand that if you have less and less available time, you have less and less disposable time in your life, then you need to get what you need to get quickly. And so it's another factor in the way things are unfolding. You know, I said there are a couple of things that converge to cause sort of where we are as a culture. And one of them is that constant redefinition, and one of them is not listening to the other side. And the third is the speed at which we live and the technology and how it feeds it. The other thing that came to my mind while you were talking just now was when you said, you know, there's always those same kind of stories that there's always an oppressed gay couple or there's the token gay couple or whatever it is on a show, that racism is always trotted out as this, you know, there's racism. I was watching Hillary Clinton's announcement speech in New York over the weekend, and I thought to myself, I don't understand something. We're not allowed to be sexist, but she's running a campaign on that she's going to be the first woman president. So her whole campaign and people who are supporting her, they're prostituting, for lack of a better word, maybe it's a good word, I don't know, her sex as a reason to make her president. I thought we're not supposed to be sexist. So, again, you know, it's situational ethics. It's situational perspective. It's whatever works in the moment. And I think that really is a bad way to live your life, whatever works in the moment. But we've become a whatever works in the moment society. And I think part of that is, in fact, rightfully set at the feet of progressivism, because one of the things that progressives have done for the last 100 years is change the name or change the appearance of what they're doing, change the name from global warming to climate change to sustainable development. As soon as it gets too hot to handle, no pun intended, as soon as you have a principle that you're trying to sell as a progressive and something happens to the language, they just change the language and that they keep doing what they're doing. Acorn didn't go away when it was determined that it was involved in so much voter fraud. Acorn just changed its legal name in 50 states and continues to operate as Acorn, involved in voter fraud. That's a very progressive thing. And so when I think about how the culture has become like that, I think how influential progressivism has become and how insidious it is within our culture, politically, our social culture, whatever, because we've taken that, let's just change the name and keep doing what we're doing. We've taken those boundaries away that I spoke of earlier, and anything goes in the moment, so that any means justifies the end. And back in the 60s, when you had the Weather Underground, which was the violent wing of the progressive movement, their justification was, well, it's okay to blow up police stations and try to blow up the Capitol, which Bill Ayers and others did. It was okay because their means, which was violence, was justified by their end, which in their mind was bringing down corrupt capitalism and installing socialism in its place. So this any means justifies its end has become the way we're living every day in every aspect of our lives. If it isn't working, change it, and the heck with what changing it means or how much confusion it creates or how much antagonism it provokes in someone. Just change it, because what's the difference anyway? I don't know what happens to a culture that thinks there are no limits, there are no boundaries, and what's the difference anyway? Because that's Hillary Clinton screaming and pounding on the desk in front of the Senate saying, you know, somebody went out one night and killed some Americans. You know, what's the difference whether it was a video or it was a planned terrorist attack? What difference does it matter? You know, what was her line? What's the difference anyway? Or what difference does that matter now? Yeah, what difference does it make? And the answer is, what most military will tell you is, it makes all the difference in the world. And it makes all the difference in the world in every aspect of our lives. And when we think nothing makes any difference anymore, we're done. We're cooked. We're finished.
Yeah, well, I think the point that she made, which is, in her mind, which is a valid one, that she made a point, and she knows that there's a real news story behind it. But she knew at the end of the day, nobody would pursue that news story. That's getting back to the business of the media, the business of politics. She knew that story would eventually die. If you look at how the Clintons ran the White House, if you look at every scandal that hit the Clintons, they knew eventually the press would give up and they would go away and they would move on to the next story, that there was a news story, there's a news cycle. And it comes and it goes and then it disappears. And then, I don't know if you remember the classic thing that they used to say is that they would release a story, then the story would come out and they would gather steam, and then the Clintons themselves would release the story. They'd say, "Oh, that's already old news. That story's already been out there. It was already a hit piece. We've already answered all those questions, and the American public has decided that it's time to move on." So it was a standard response they always gave, and it always worked. And the reality is, I mean, Carol, nothing has happened with the Benghazi story. Nothing has happened. People have moved on. And I think that's what's led to a level of frustration with, I would say, real thinking Americans and Americans that want to see some justice in the American political system, that there are people do get penalized for the errors that they make. I mean, just use a silly example. If anybody in the private sector had ever done what Bill Clinton did, his career would have been over. There's no question about it. Some of the things that Barney Frank did, some of the things that some of these other politicians have did, and we can spend an hour talking about it, they'd be completely done in any other private sector job. But the politicians know it's a game. If they can get it off the news cycle, everything goes and everything can move forward. Why? Because there's political agendas at work and there's business interests at work. And the most important thing is the political and business interests, and that's the bigger story. And until we get really serious about it, or I should say the media gets really serious about it, people like, we're going to continue to get people like Hillary Clinton. We deserve Hillary Clinton, because she's allowed to run, because the press does not call her out on the things that she's done. We've seen a little bit with this latest book by Peter Schweizer that has essentially made her hide for the last 2 months, and she's only finally coming out of her shell now. But I think we need more of that type of reporting that really exposes the light on some of these people.
Well, you have some of those reporters out there. You have the Michelle Malkins, and you have the Cheryl Atkinsons, who had to leave mainstream media because she couldn't take the lying and the manipulation, and she's got her own website now. Michelle Malkin is absolutely fearless, beyond fearless. You have a couple of those people. Now, by the way, Cheryl Atkinson is not a conservative. Michelle Malkin is. Cheryl Atkinson is just someone who was a highly respected a mainstream media reporter. I think she was with ABC, and she just couldn't take it anymore. And she has done a lot of exposés on the corruption both within the government and within the media. The problem is that what the progressive mentality that I spoke about earlier infected our universities decades ago, and we turn out journalists today who are little robots and they're little soldiers for the progressive movement. And so we don't really have journalists like we once had. We don't, you know, whether it was Walter Cronkite or it was Huntley and Brinkley or whoever there were. I know it was the Chet Huntley was an alcoholic, and these people are all human and fallible. But we actually had reporting at a point in time, and we had people, Woodward and Bernstein, willing and able to do something about exposing the corruption. It just doesn't exist anymore. And again, I go back to a big part of the blame is on the technology. One of the reasons that we don't care, we the people, is because we're so exhausted. We are so inundated with data and the speed at which we have to do things in our lives because of the technology, because of the way we live, that we don't have time to get the information and to care about the information that we get. We're too busy. We're very much in survival mode, even though we may not be poor financially, even though there are those of us that are, you know, middle class or upper lower class, almost middle class, and we have our basic needs met and we're paying our bills, but we are nonetheless in survival mode pretty much 24/7. Because you can't stop for a minute and actually go deep into anything because there are 10 other things on your plate that need immediate attention, and that includes your family first and then your job, and then it goes on and on and on. So, you know, the technology has facilitated the progressive movement, because the progressive movement needs you not to think. It needs you to buy platitudes. It needs you not to ask questions. It needs you to believe that there are a few people who can steer you in the direction that you need to go in, and that you should listen to them and follow them and trust them because they're smarter and richer and they know better. And they claim that they have your interest at heart, and they claim they're about the collective, but they're the John Kerrys riding around in their own Lear jets and docking their boats out of state, their yachts, so they don't have to pay taxes. They're the Hillary Clintons who haven't driven a vehicle since the 1990s, who has no sense of reality, not possible. They're the Bill Gateses. They're the people, not that he isn't charitable, but he's a screaming progressive, and he's involved in some very progressive causes. They're the people who think that they know better than everybody else, and so they can run the show. The progressive movement has infected our consciousness through our universities, our consciousness through the media, and I don't blame the media for not ratting out the corruption in politics, because there's always been corruption in politics. Shakespeare wrote about it, and there's always been media there to expose it. I blame us, because we are like little rats or gerbils on a wheel, spinning around, and so many of us are afraid to step off and try to live a different way. And as long as we keep spinning that wheel, as long as we keep treading that wheel, they'll keep that wheel in place and they'll keep it spinning. I think it's for us to wake up, not to wait for the press to do it for us.
I agree, Carol. I have nothing more to add here.
So we hope you've enjoyed the show. We've given you extra time tonight, because we actually believe that this was an important show and there were thoughts that Steve and I wanted to put out there to have you think about and share with your friends and generate discussion. You know, I did post about this today on our blog site above the FrayPodcast.com. Steve posts to it regularly, too. Check it out in your spare time and spread the word. Steve and I are here Monday and Thursday nights for your pleasure. For your hopefully mind expansion, and we share with you everything we have from the bottom of our hearts and the tops of our minds, because we really believe that individuals can make a difference. One person can change the world, and has often in either direction, for the good or for the ill. You could be that one person, but unless you're engaged, thinking for yourself, and willing to stand for what you believe in, it can't happen. So thanks for listening to Above the Fray. I'm Carol Gold.
I'm Steve Clark.
And join us again on, what would that be, Steve, Thursday night at 7 p.m. I'm back here at 6 p.m., sorry, Central, 7 p.m. Eastern. I'm here tomorrow night, 6:30, Inspirational Gold. That's the intuitive in me, does the news from a higher perspective, and also takes calls on air for guidance and reading. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.